listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the November 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's this month's editor's letter from Editor-in-Chief Radhika Jones. The power and the glory. The establishment can seem like a concept out of sync with our times. Those 20th century titans of industry who amassed supremacy and sway based on tangible things, iron, steel, celluloid images. Those guys whose names were chiseled onto banks and libraries. They read like fossils of an earlier epoch, the Stone Age of influence. Not the people in our century don't slap their family crest on buildings, but the gesture is less everlasting. Ask any board member debating privately or publicly whether the name Sackler or Epstein remains capable of heralding artistic achievement or scientific inquiry when they've become synonymous with abuse, epidemic, and scandal. But the idea of an establishment remains helpful as long as it can contour and flex with the moment. It's good to get a handle on who's calling the shots on our money, our votes, our eyeballs. We live in their world, whether we celebrate, fear, or loathe them. The cultural elite is more fluid these days, thankfully. The political elite more mercurial. The financial elite, kinda, sorta, mostly the same. But let's see how the economy is doing 12 months from now. For our annual new establishment list this fall, now in its 25th year, our team of editors, led by John Homans, Ben Landy, and Claire Lansbaum, made some structural changes. They broke down our group of 100 into 10 categories, the better to show how the establishment itself has fractured, even as it intertwines. Throughout this issue, power manifests in myriad forms. Hasan Minhaj pokes at the lion's den from the stage of Patriot Act, his Netflix show, which is in its fourth season. Emily Weiss invented Glossier, the beauty company, valued at $1.2 billion, that doubles as a way of life. Emma Chamberlain, the rising Gen Z siren of YouTube, leads our portfolio of famous creators who are, as Richard Lawson writes in his accompanying essay, navigating success in new ways now that YouTube celebrity has begun to resemble establishment celebrity. Not something we might have imagined when the age of user-generated content began and the platform's stars tended to be, as Richard writes, earnest kids on the edge of their beds. And in an excerpt from his new book, Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney, reflects on his friendship and partnership with Steve Jobs. Jobs died 8 years ago this fall, and as I read Bob's story, I wondered how our world might be different if he were still here. If he were bringing his exacting, perfectionist point of view to our stormy seascape of technology, media, and entertainment. There are people on our new establishment list right now whose presence on Earth holds great import. What they do will determine whether the planet remains livable for humans, whether our elections will be tampered with, whether a kid aspires to start a business or go into comedy, or pick up a tennis racket because he or she sees that it can be done. The establishment isn't a collective colossus anymore, nor does it rely on institutional power. It is individual, unexpected, and far-reaching, and that's what makes it new. Thank you. Here are some of the contributors to this month's issue. Sloane Crosley, The Lion Tamer. Hassan and I both speak fluent Suburbia, says Crosley, whose latest book of essays, Look Alive Out There, is out in paperback. He's also pointed out the cultural similarities between Jews and Indians. So allow me to say, he's a minch. It's this leveling that makes him such an effective performer. Everyone feels kinship. Marissa Meltzer, Face Value. Meltzer calls Emily Weiss, the founder of Glossier, ambitious and determined, but she has a dreamy quality as well. Like you could leave her in a room alone, and an hour later, she would have an outline for a novel, or for an improved Barbie dream home. Meltzer's book about the founder of Weight Watchers, This Is Big, will be published in April. Richard Lawson, TheirTube. Successful YouTubers go from kids recording in their bedroom to seasoned pros very quickly, says Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson, who has been documenting YouTube culture since he reported from VidCon in 2015. YouTube may seem silly, and often is, but these people take it very seriously, and so should we. Mae Jong, Patriot Act. I had been wanting to do something on sex work for a while, but hadn't quite managed to find a way into the story, says Jong, who served as a war correspondent in Afghanistan. When the news about Robert Kraft broke down in Florida, I knew this was my chance. Charlotte Rutherford, Opening Act. The British photographer and director calls Camila Morani super sweet and playful. I wanted to make images that felt classic, confident, and feminine, with a focus on Camila's movement and expression. I really enjoyed shooting her. She's naturally very warm and makes everything look effortless.
Thank you.
opening act. Earlier this year, Camila Moroni sent shivers through South by Southwest and jolted a standing ovation at the Cannes Film Festival with her performance in Annabelle Attanasio's film Mickey and the Bear. Her breakout role as the daughter of an opioid-addicted veteran reaches audiences nationwide this month. And now the American actor and model, who happens to call Leonardo DiCaprio her boyfriend, is taking the lead. Here, some insights gleaned from an evening at home with Hollywood's newest heroine, as interviewed by Britt Hennemuth. She was born in Los Angeles to two Argentinian actors. Growing up in Hollywood, you can't really run from it, and attended Beverly Hills High School. Our apartment happened to be in the school district. It was very weird when my classmates were getting $100,000 cars, because that was so not my reality. She earned her role as the titular Mickey from a self-tape audition shot in her mother's kitchen. A day after her callback, she flew to the film's location in remote Montana, where fast food was the norm. She favors McDonald's Chicken McNuggets, extra-large fries, and an Oreo McFlurry. Vanilla always. She calls Al Pacino, who dated her mother for years, a stepfather figure. He watched an early cut of Mickey and the Bear and sent along his helpful thoughts to the first-time director. The edits were made. The indie film is being hailed for its poignant closing scene. When reflecting on famous cinematic finales, she insists Rick should have gotten on the plane in Casablanca and that there was enough room for Jack to fit on the Titanic door that saved Rose. She recently finished Conversations with Friends by Sally Rooney in less than 48 hours. She calls it the best book ever, but isn't rooting for a screen adaptation. I can't play either character, so I'm not interested. You'd be surprised by the amount of Spanx in her closet, as well as the fake diamond tiara she wears every birthday. Her happy place is her bed, next to which hangs a picture of an elephant named Zongoloni, which she adopted through Kenya's Sheldrick Wildlife Trust. It costs $50 a year to keep them rehabilitated. It makes for a great Christmas present. She insists she's rarely hit on, but the worst pickup line she's ever received is, "You have the most beautiful eyes," she retorts. "They're not. They're brown and shitty." Her ideal date involves a great movie, an Italian dinner, and my glass of house cab. That's the only thing I know how to order at a restaurant, because I don't know anything about wine. She defended the 22-year age gap between her and DiCaprio by posting an archival photo of Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart, whose own age difference was 4 years more, for her nearly 2 million Instagram followers. "I've been starting to show my sense of humor more," she says. "People will always have awful things to say because there's a sense of entitlement and safety behind the screen. But trust me, you don't need to be that angry." She cringes when revisiting a private moment captured by paparazzi at the Hotel du Cap en Roque in Antibes, DiCaprio diligently snapping iPhone photos of her posed arabesque. "I saw the meme. You either die a hero or you live long enough to become an Instagram boyfriend." Poor thing, he's being called an Instagram boyfriend. He's an environmentalist and a movie star, and it doesn't mean anything. Death to the new establishment. Long may they reign. So much for making the world a better place. After years of scandals, our new masters of the universe appear even more ruthless than the old guard they displaced. By Nick Bilton. In San Francisco, the crown jewel of Silicon Valley, there are no poor neighborhoods, just poor people. Squeezed between million-dollar apartments and Michelin-starred restaurants is a rising tide of homelessness. Vagrants begging for scraps from the tech zillionaires on Market Street. Families who couldn't afford the rent after the latest IPO. Uber drivers sleeping in their cars in the Safeway parking lot. The nouveau wealth capital of America is a land of decadence and irony, where Juul, banned from selling e-cigarettes in the county, just bought a $400 million office tower, and Vinod Khosla thinks he owns the beach. Farther down the 101 in Menlo Park and Sunnyvale, Facebook and Google employees are raising their kids tech-free. This is the world the smartphone has built. In 1994, Vanity Fair inaugurated the new establishment list to celebrate the rise of a new entrepreneurial class that promised, how young we were then, to make the world a better place. They were digital age whiz kids challenging the old boys club, rebels and hackers getting their first taste of real power. 25 years later, the upstarts are now the establishment, the undisputed titans of America's second gilded age. How quickly it all changed. Twitter, which aided the Arab Spring, now abets America's culture civil war, and its co-founder Jack Dorsey is more concerned with going on silent retreats than silencing Nazis. Mark Zuckerberg, who dreamed of bringing free internet to Africa, spends his days dodging questions about the genocide in Myanmar. Dara Khosrowshahi has righted the amoral culture of Uber, but is struggling to squeeze profits from its gig economy workforce. For SoftBank leader Masayoshi Son, self-driving cars can't come soon enough. Even Slack, which was going to save us from the drudgery of work, has merely insinuated drudgery deeper into the fabric and the fiber of our lives. Unwinding the problems these entrepreneurs have wrought is difficult, as anyone on the 2019 new establishment list can attest. YouTube's Susan Wojcicki has spoken passionately of trying to strike a balance between removing hate speech and cultivating free expression, but is quick with excuses when pressed on the specifics. If we were to take down every video, poor Zuckerberg couldn't for the life of him figure out how to rid Facebook of anti-vaxxers or Russian bots, at least until regulators began threatening multi-billion-dollar fines and high-profile tech insiders, including Tristan Harris and Roger McNamee, began speaking publicly about breaking up the company. "Fish don't see water," one tech investor explained, when I ask how Silicon Valley sees itself in this age of cultural backlash. Another senior-level tech employee, who has worked in the industry for more than a decade, wasn't so kind. "I don't think they smell their own shit," she said. There is still a sense of wonder. Elon Musk is planning a Mars colony. Satya Nadella is pouring money into artificial intelligence. Larry Page has invested in flying cars. Wojcicki's younger sister, Anne, is building a genetic database that is already being used to design new drugs. With a $300 million investment from GlaxoSmithKline and fuel cutting-edge academic research, Jeff Bezos has teamed up with titans of the financial industry to lower healthcare cost, while Brian Armstrong's cryptocurrency exchange, Coinbase, aims to disrupt the financial industry altogether. In Hollywood, technology has forced the studios to compete with Netflix and Amazon, fueling another golden age of video. Meanwhile, venture capital is flowing outward, remaking the world for better and worse. There are startups growing flawless diamonds with plasma reactors, plant-based meats that bleed beet juice, shoes made from eucalyptus fibers. One startup founder I recently met is growing genetically modified mushrooms that can be turned into imitation leather for belts and shoes, reducing the need for cows and helping slow climate change. 1,000 artisan villages in India won't know what hit them. Mark Andreessen, the founder of Netscape and one half of the eponymous VC firm Andreessen Horowitz, used to say that software eats the world. These days, it feels more appropriate to say that Silicon Valley eats the world, or has eaten it already. Hashtag Me Too and What Came After. The reporters who helped ignite a movement reflect on its stunning success and the enormous work that remains by Claire Lansbaum. With their explosive story on Harvey Weinstein, New York Times reporters and new establishment veterans Megan Toohey and Jody Cantor planted a grenade in the cultural psyche and pulled the pin. They pursued scraps of whispers and convinced very unwilling sources to speak out against one of the most powerful men in Hollywood, all the while butting up against a legal system, white shoe lawyers, corporate obfuscation, non-disclosure agreements designed to protect him. The resulting exposé divided the modern world into two distinct epochs, before the Weinstein story broke and after. There's definitely been a palpable shift in institutions and mores and minds. Workplaces have installed entire new rule books. Media outlets are much more responsive to sexual scandal, and powerful men are on notice as to how they should behave. Yet on a deeper level, the effects of the hashtag MeToo movement are harder to quantify. Women are still fighting for their place in politics and industry. Donald Trump remains in the White House despite multiple allegations of sexual assault. When writer E. Jean Carroll recently wrote, very believably, of being raped by Trump in a department store dressing room in the mid-1990s, the New York Times hardly treated it as news. Trump has denied the allegation. Meanwhile, men who have acknowledged sexual harassment and worse, who apologized and went underground, are now attempting to resurface. Cantor and Tui chronicle some of this paradigm shift in their new book, She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite a Movement, which presents a TikTok of their efforts to unmask Weinstein, as well as their reporting on Christine Blasey Ford's agonizing decision to testify against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. They go deeper on the topic here, parsing the systems that have failed, the movement that's picked up the slack, and the new reality it has left in its wake. Hashtag MeToo's unfinished business. Megan Tui, our article in October 2017 felt like it was just the beginning. We had been able to connect some of the dots about Harvey Weinstein's decades of alleged predation and those who helped him, but there were still so many pressing questions. There was the question of the women who faced wrenching decisions as they debated whether or not to come forward and share their stories. There was the question of the machinery in place to silence those women and try to block our investigation. We wanted to pull the curtain back on that machinery, and we wanted to get into the question of complicity. One of the most pressing questions when it comes to these individual predators is, this was somebody who was engaged in this behavior for decades. Who were the individuals and institutions that glimpsed their wrongdoing, and what did they do about it? Jody Cantor, we say in the beginning of the book, thank you for witnessing what we witnessed and hearing what we heard. We wanted to bring readers to ground zero and say, go through this process of examining this with us so you can have your own conversations. Journalism's power and its limits. JK, at a time when the President of the United States talks about journalists as enemies of the state, at a time when we've all been figuring out what the new financial model is for journalism, at a time when it feels like the truth is fracturing, I think Megan's and my response is to show our work. We are totally transparent about what goes into this, and this is an example of facts driving social change. The reaction to this story was so outsized, and hashtag MeToo has become both an example and a test of social change in our time. We feel that we lived the experience of careful information actually moving the needle and having an impact on people's lives. Since October of 2017, we've been flooded with messages from women who want to tell us their stories, and there have been times when we felt overwhelmed, because there's no way that any publication, even a publication with the resources of the Times, could ever get to every one of the stories. So many systems have failed, And of course, we want journalism to step in and do what it can. But journalism can't compensate for an entire system that's broken. The future of a movement. J.K., like everyone else, we have been staggered by the size and durability of this movement. It doesn't feel like a news story anymore. It feels like a way of being. I think we all experienced it this summer with the Jeffrey Epstein story, which brings up a lot of the same questions as the Weinstein story. How could this have gone unaddressed or inadequately addressed for so long? How could so many people have been complicit? What is behind this seemingly prestigious world that is clearly masking something much darker? Epstein, like Weinstein, is a sprawling story that's shocking in the sheer number of allegations, the number of women who appear to have been hurt. We feel that you can't solve a problem you can't see, and all of us collectively are still in the process of seeing that problem clearly for the first time. And clearly, we all have a lot of work to do on that. We also understand that hashtag MeToo has become controversial. Basically, there are three questions about hashtag MeToo issues that are totally unresolved. 1. What kind of behaviors are under scrutiny? Are we talking about Aziz Ansari? Yes or no? 2. How are we evaluating this information? What are the tools we're using to figure out what actually happened? And 3. What's the punishment or accountability that we're going to use? Each of those three questions is a matter of huge debate. How much has hashtag MeToo changed, really? MT, there's no question that some of the secrecy around sexual harassment and sexual assault has been shattered. For so long, as reporters looking to uncover these types of stories, we were the ones having people slam the door in our face. To have this reversal, in which tips and victims are now coming to us, is massively significant. At the same time, there hasn't been the type of systemic reform that both the accusers and the accused are looking for. For instance, secret settlements with restrictive clauses helped conceal the conduct of Harvey Weinstein for years. Those types of settlements are still being signed every single day. J.K., it's confounding because everything's changed and nothing's changed. On the one hand, we've been through a seismic social shift and a change in attitude, and things that were accepted, tolerated, dismissed a couple of years ago are now taken much more seriously. I do think that on a corporate level, people are aware that the reputational risk of protecting a predator is much greater than the reputational risk of doing something about it. The calculus has changed. On the other hand, our basic systems for preventing and dealing with these problems have barely changed at all. Nothing has happened that says to us legally and structurally the United States is taking a new approach to this problem. I do think there's a private reckoning that's taken place alongside the public one, and in some ways the private one has been much more powerful. The public conversation about hashtag MeToo has been loud and fractious and controversial, but in private conversations, whether they're in offices or in bars or among old friends, I think what you hear is a much more searching and delicate reevaluation of old behavior. You hear people allowing themselves to be vulnerable and to question things that happened years ago that they accepted that no longer seem right. Sometimes I think that as reporters, we can never capture the true power of what's happened, because one function of the news reporting and the public conversation is to drive these really significant private ones that most of us will never hear about. MT, we can't necessarily predict how systemic change will work, and how these reforms will come about, and what they'll look like, but we can continue to do our jobs every day as reporters, which is to unearth and publish the facts. Jeffrey Epstein's meritocrat grift. He helped broker the 90s marriage between money and science, and in his extreme entitlement and heedlessness, he mirrored establishment values by Gabriel Sherman. Jeffrey Epstein once told a billionaire that he'd invented the derivatives market, a claim that is totally false. But without question, he helped create one of the signal trades of the last few decades. He came to prominence in the 1990s as the modern meritocracy was taking shape in the collision between the cult of technology and the burgeoning class of billionaires. Epstein played a role in this marriage. He was one of the people who figured out how to arbitrage the particular needs, desires, and vulnerabilities of these groups. He recognized, long before others, that Wall Street, Silicon Valley, Park Avenue, and the Academy were converging around a new salon culture embodied by TED Talks and billionaires' dinners. Genius wanted to ride on a private plane. It deserved to travel by private plane. And billionaires wanted to certify their own genius by conversing with other geniuses. MIT and Harvard were brand names the super rich wanted to associate with, a fact that dropout Epstein understood innately. Science was sexy, a way to beat the markets. He once told an academic that he gamed the stock market by studying mating patterns of termites. Epstein grasped that for the new meritocrats, genius and great wealth were two sides of the same coin, and that the health of capitalism inevitably required both. The girls, he always called them girls, were there too. For many in his glittery circle, they were decoration, seen but not heard or touched. None of them raised alarms about this situation. A person of means did not have to live by the rest of the world's rules. Epstein's own Brooklyn accent and lack of a college degree, his idiosyncratic background, were no hindrance here, but somehow a badge of his special gifts. He was mysterious, boundary-pushing, living in that strange house, as big as an embassy, the former Birch Wathen School on 71st Street. Then and now, no one knew exactly how he made his money. Beyond his having managed money for the apparel billionaire Les Wexner, Epstein's only public client, who knew what to believe? The former Bear Stearns CEO Jimmy Kane told people Epstein made a killing trading foreign currencies. Apollo Global Management co-founder Leon Black told colleagues Epstein was the smartest tax advisor he'd ever met. Epstein was said to run money for the Rockefellers and the Bronfmans, though both denied it. A longtime Epstein employee confided in friends that she still has no idea what her boss actually did for a living. He'd call the office and say he wanted her to find a $10,000 umbrella he saw in Paris, and she'd have to buy it. He was very, very demanding, but you weren't allowed to ask questions. It was not a normal co-worker relationship, a source familiar with how Epstein's office ran recalled. Epstein's glib confidence was validating to a cohort that craves sure things. In this way, he had some resemblance to figures like Donald Trump, Bernie Madoff, Elizabeth Holmes. Jonathan Farkas, an heir to the Alexander's department store fortune, recalled meeting Epstein in the Hamptons during the recession of 1982 and being buoyed by Epstein's absolute certainty that he knew where the economy was going. I'll never forget this. The stock market had dropped to around 700 points from 1,000. And one day, Jeffrey just said, "You'll never see it below 1,000 for the rest of your life. It will never go down," Farkas told me. He was right. And in those circles, he was clubbable. He's incredibly glib. He's charming. He's quick. One acquaintance, a Wall Street player, recalled. His casualness, the sweatshirts, the jeans, were an aggression, keeping his people off balance. Epstein treated the fanciest people in the world with complete irreverence in a way they were unaccustomed to. He let it be known that he called Prince Andrew Andy, the Wall Streeter told me. He presented his interest in women as another noble eccentricity. He never hid it. Epstein reportedly once told an academic he only had two interests, science and sex. Epstein had an arsenal of self-presentations, depending on his audience. He was one of these people who didn't talk much. He wanted you to think he was thinking profound thoughts. You always wondered if there was any there, a private equity executive who dealt with Epstein told me. But a constant was his social braggadocio, both vanity and part of his method. He name-dropped like crazy. You'd be with him, and he'd say things like, "I just got off the phone with Zuckerberg. I just got off the phone with Rothschild. I just got off the phone with Gates." recalled another Wall Streeter who did business with him. Epstein boasted about buying yachts and planes and setting up arcane tax shelters for the super rich. You didn't know if any of it was true, but then you'd be meeting at his townhouse several days later, and Gates would be there. Jeffrey had a way of making these people materialize. Scientists were the central currency in this social trade, supplying intellectual heft while certifying him as a man of science, which he wasn't, though he had no shortage of loopy ideas, which reportedly included a plan for Epstein to impregnate dozens of women at his New Mexico ranch to improve humanity with his DNA. Epstein began courting academics in the early 1990s, at a moment when geek culture was rapidly gaining power. This was due in large measure to the promotion of Epstein's friend, the New York literary agent and entrepreneur John Brockman, who transformed academics like Jared Diamond, Daniel Dennett, Richard Dawkins, and Steven Pinker into best-selling authors. With Brockman's imprimatur, Epstein spent heavily to buy into the academy, becoming known as a science philanthropist with a Cheshire smile and a baggy Harvard sweatshirt. He pledged $30 million to Harvard, fed at academics at champagne-fueled dinners at his 21,000-square-foot townhouse, hosted science conferences on his private Caribbean island, and jetted them around on his 727. Not every scientist bought Epstein's lines. Dennett recalled being summoned to a private meeting at Epstein's townhouse and thinking he was a phony. He asked me manipulative questions as a conversational gambit. I remember he said, "Suppose I gave you $1 billion. What would you do with it?" I said I would fund an independent news organization for the whole world, and we'd hire the best reporters and give away the journalism. He had no interest in my answer. It was about showing off his wealth. Pinker recalled a flight on Epstein's plane to a TED conference. At one point, I was summoned for an audience with Epstein in his office on the plane, which included an incongruous big wooden desk and executive chair. I had been told that Epstein had a brilliant mind and was interested in the cutting edge of science, consciousness, genetics, evolution, cosmology, and that he wanted to discuss my work with me. He would ask me a question, get bored with my answer after a sentence, interrupt me, ask another question, impatiently interrupt me again, and so on, in a conversation that lasted perhaps 10 minutes, before I was dismissed and could return to the more satisfying conversations at the back of the plane, Pinker said. Epstein's ADD and intellectual laziness led me to conclude he was a kibitzer who liked to hang out with intellectual celebrities he had bought, and I wanted no part of him, though could not avoid him entirely because he would pop up at events he'd partly funded. This was years before anyone knew about his sexual crimes. Most of Epstein's friends and acquaintances did not abuse the women in his world, but almost no one, including journalists, pointed out the oddness of a middle-aged man traveling with several young women. It's as if his wealth, and this was what he thought, justified this behavior. Epstein's suicide while imprisoned at one of the world's most secure jails, El Chapo, Bernie Madoff, and the 1993 World Trade Center bombers were housed there, will provide him with a perfect elitist afterlife of conspiracy theories. Did Mossad kill him to cover up that Epstein was an agent running an underage honeypot operation designed to gather compromise on intelligence targets, people ask? Was it super rich friends for whom he'd outlived his usefulness? Was it Hillary Clinton? Trump, not surprisingly, retweeted a theory to that effect. But the truth may be simpler and uglier. In his staggering entitlement, his narcissism, his heedlessness, his numerous self-justifications, unapologetic elitism, Epstein is a mirror of the modern establishment. When the grift stops working, why stay alive? This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.